the open mind, free to examine, to question, to disagree. Our subject today, nostalgia for the 1930s. Your host on The Open Mind is Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University and author of Rendezvous with Destiny and the Crucial Decade.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Every generation, I suppose, has its own nostalgia, its own period it looks back to as the good old days. When World War II ended, we gave the impression of a nation that might have a nostalgia for the 1920s. But nowadays, the climate of opinion seems to be shifting. And to millions of thoughtful America, there is a nostalgia for, of all periods, the Depression period, the 1930s. People are saying that was a period when we were alive, when we were creative, when we didn't huddle together in the middle of the road. And the publishers, who are more or less sound judges of the public mood, seem to be confirming this trend. They certainly are about to bestow upon us a raft of books about the 1930s. So our panel today, all very much men of the 1930s in the course of their careers. Here to my right, the celebrated American artist, Mr. Ben Shahn, who in the minds of so many of us is a symbol of the artistic and intellectual ferment of the 30s. Next to him, Mr. Raymond Moley, the organizer of the original Franklin Roosevelt Brain Trust, later a critic of the New Deal, at present author of Newsweek magazine's Perspective Page and a widely syndicated column. Next to him, Mr. Benjamin Goodman. It sounds very strange putting it that way. Of course, the Benny Goodman of the great swing band of the 1930s. Next to him, Mr. A.H. Raskin, now of the editorial board of the New York Times, who in the 1930s covered a number of the emerging New Deal agencies. And here across from me, Mr. Hamilton Fish, congressman from New York, who through most of the New Deal days was the ranking Republican member of both the House Rules Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, vigorous opponent of the FDR policies, foreign and domestic, and one-third of the target of the famous Roosevelt crack denouncing Martin, Barton, and Fish. Mr. Shahn, would you get us going by a comment from this fine anthology about the 30s, Don Congdon's? He quotes here a gentleman who says of the 30s that it was a period during which the men, women, and children in America loved more strongly, felt more deeply, generated more warmth, and held more compassion for their fellow men than ever in our history, before or since. He says the people had more character, and never was the nation's heartbeat more loud and more clear.
Well, that was very beautifully put. It really brings up a recollection that becomes so vivid, and I would agree with every word of it. But at the same time, I am sort of two minds about the 30s. It was that. But is my nostalgia due to the fact that I was 30 years younger?
Oh. Well, Mr. Raskin, you weren't.
Well, I was 30 years younger, and I was really quite young. I came out of the college, out of City College in 1931, and I was one of the fortunate members of my class. I got a job on the New York Times as a college correspondent at $12 a week, and $3 a week more for going to church on Sunday and writing about the sermon. So that made me really one of the privileged people in my class.
Mr. Moley, I see you stirring.
I was in my maturity in the 1930s. And I still feel that I am in the 1960s. I find the 1960s just as exciting as the 1930s, but in a different way.
What is the later. Difference? Oh, we want to hold
The difference that? Is that in the 1960s is a sort of revival of the policies of the late 1930s, because most of the young men in the Kennedy administration were in the formative period of their life at that time, and they're really recreating the late 1930s. I distinguish between the early 1930s and the late. I can explain
you,
that later.
You approve a good deal more of the earlier ones than the later ones, I gather.
I certainly do.
Mr. Goodman, you were in Chicago then, were you not?
Not all the time. I was
partly in Chicago, and as a matter of fact, it's very difficult for me to even think about nostalgia because we were doing six shows a day at the Paramount Theater and doubling at the Pennsylvania Hotel at the evening, and many other theaters like that, and also doing moving pictures in California, besides playing at the Palomar Ballroom. So it's kind of hard for me to remember all the special things we had then don't exist now. Yeah. But seems to me, I've always heard old-timers talk about the good old days in that sense, you know. And
Are these musicians referring to the 30s as the...
Well, the or any other particular thing, or the way the mechanics worked, or the way they, other people, or they did things this way and that, but that seems to be historic, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Way back.
Way
back, yeah.
About it always used to be better, or much more this and much more that. You know? So it's difficult always to put it in one particular solid form.
Well, Mr. Fish, you were in Washington.
Yes, I was in Congress during the entire 1930s. I came from the congressional district in which President Roosevelt lived and Secretary Morgenthau. I'm not here, however, this evening as a spokesman for former President Roosevelt. I did know
I'm
him
surprised,
personally very well, and at the outset, for the first 5 or 6 months, I voted for many of the New Deal measures that I even voted for Social Security and thought he did a very good job until he started to recognize Soviet Russia. That's where I split with Roosevelt, who up to then had been rather personally friendly with me and had been mutual because we'd known each other for many years. From that time, I gained the idea he was setting himself up as a one-man government, sort of a dictatorship at home, and I fought him steadily from that moment on.
I wonder if we could explore for a moment this element of the alleged tremendous vitality and creativity of this period in all fields. Mr. Sean,
I'd like to speak a moment of my field. I spent a good part of the 20s in France completely ignoring what was going on in the States here. We all ran away. We thought there was freedom there and there wasn't any here. And with the beginning of the 30s, and that is with the beginning of the Roosevelt administration, and I might say I will speak for Roosevelt for a moment, with the beginning of the administration and the beginning of the recognition of the fact that there are people who profess to do certain things by which they must earn a living, whether they be artists or writers or musicians. And the following things happened: the competitiveness that exists today in the galleries, 400 galleries, each one trying to outdo the other, ceased to exist at that moment. We became interested in things infinitely more basic. The revival of fresco, an ancient medium, the revival of the tempera media, also an ancient medium, suddenly we became interested in these media, how they were done. We helped each other. We found out something. We told this one about it, and this one told us something about it. And there was this almost early Renaissance vitality that I had not felt before or have not felt since.
This has ceased after the 30s.
This has ceased it ceased after the war. The war was an interruption that you can't really figure, but it ceased immediately after the war.
The Kennedy cultural efforts have not...
I see very little of it.
Yeah.
The bringing in of a portrait of Benjamin Franklin is hardly fits in the vitality of today's art.
Well, Mr. Goldman, may I say just a word up before we get too carried away with this nostalgic feeling? I certainly agree that in many of the cultural fields, certainly in social inventiveness, in a feeling of warmth and interest on the part of people toward other people, that this was a very rich period. On the other hand, it was also a period of enormous frustration, of great social misery, which persisted right up until the war period sort of delivered us out of that. Mm-hmm. So that I don't look back on it as one of the periods that really was a noble period for the people who had to suffer through the 13 million unemployed with which we started that decade and the very large numbers we had all the way through it.
Well, it seems to me that they went along together. The thing that you approve of and you think was noble, that which was ignoble, seemed to go along simultaneously. I'll never forget an image that I saw. I got out of the station at Times Square. And there was a bread line towards that little booth that exists in Times Square where they have a recruiting booth now, stretching for blocks. And it was a similar line to get into the Paramount facing north.
Well, referring to your statement about the artists helping themselves and each other and so forth.
Yes.
Well, don't you think, in a sense, that in a big business way, the art business has gotten so big? You mentioned 400 galleries in New York City. And it's inevitable when you have a big business out of a thing like that that you have so much more to choose from. What is finally good in the last analysis is another thing, and I refer that to music. We have many composers and great quantities of music being written and avant-garde music and so forth, but what will eventually remain remains to be seen.
Well, I don't judge it from what will remain, because no one here would dare to say what will remain and what will not remain.
That, but it certainly can't all remain.
No, it can't all remain.
We know
but
that.
The warmth, the feeling of man toward man is the thing that I remember very vividly, and I think that is lacking today, and I miss it.
Well, then there was the application of the power of the state to try to do something for people, the feeling that society was not a helpless instrument drifting along. I'm sure Mr. Moley, who was so much the architect of a lot of that early legislation, could give us a little of his thinking about it and then his disenchantment with it.
Well, I would say this, that the greatness in any nation is achieved in, that is, their finest hour, as Churchill put it, is achieved in periods when there is this stress, when there is a struggle for existence, when there is poverty, when there is a fierce competition. And that is what hardens the individual's character, that's what hardens a nation's character. And consequently, it seems to me that the 1930s represented that sort of a period. I always regretted the extent to which the hardening of the character of the American people ended in too much dependence, let us say, on government. But that's another question and a controversial one.
Well, Mr. Fish, you and Mr. Moley both, in your opening remarks, made a distinction between the earlier phase of the 30s and the later. You, the very early, and you, somewhat later, but you're making some distinction.
Oh, very much so. Much to my surprise, I didn't know Mr. Moley had left the New Deal corner so soon. In fact, he left it just about the time, the early part, the first 6 months. That's when I differed with him. I was all for these early measures. Roosevelt came in, he had to do certain things. And one of them, of course, was to put the business back on its feet and get people employed. And he had to spend a great deal of money to do it, and he had to pass certain laws that were necessary, one of which was the Social Security, which was a great deal of, I admit there was a great deal of conflict over it, but
still
I supported
is.
It as a necessity at that time. But after that, I think that there was no real definite policy. As you say, there were a great many unemployed throughout that whole 1930. At the end of 1930, there were 5 or 6 million unemployed. I think that's one of the reasons for the war. I think a lot of the people thought that was the way out in the administration, to get into the war, because they had no fiscal policy whatever. It was simply a question of more debts, more taxes, more deficits, and more bond issues. There was absolutely no type or kind of fiscal policy the last 5 or 6 years of the Roosevelt administration.
Well, could we hold for a moment now this political discussion to try to say a little more about this question of general vitality? I notice, Mr. Goodman, when people write about your work in the jazz field, they, of course, associate it with the vogue of swing. And they make the coming of swing a tremendous phenomenon in this country, in the sense that before that we had simply disorganized music, so to speak, and swing puts it together into a tight pattern, etc. Does this represent in your field any of the same sort of thing that Mr. Shawn is talking about in the art field? Was the jazz world an exciting world then, in a sense that it isn't now?
Well, it was exciting. It was very, very exciting to us, because I think it stemmed certainly before me. Because I remember listening to records when I was very young. I would say 15 or 10 years before I started to have my own band. And there were certain people who would started before that, even as going far as back as Ted Lewis and Paul Whiteman, and we had jazz then, but it was a vulgar name at that time. Yeah. Now it's culture. In those days, it was a vulgar name because it was only played in rather low down places and so called dance halls and places like that. And
well, one of these critics, Mr. Goodman, says that swing in the 30s, when you were at your height, was more popular with the American people than any form of music has been in any other period. Now, whether he's correct or not, why do you think swing was so popular? Does it say something about the 30s?
The music itself?
The music itself, yeah.
Gosh, it's hard for me to say. You know, I was so busy doing
it
at that time.
Was it really a great creative period, though, in general? I don't think of the theater as having been enormously vital.
I would disagree with that.
But not great things. There were a few things of social significance, but none of them were really lasting. Waiting for Lefty, Awake and Sing, a few Lillian Hellman things. In literature, you had some things by Steinbeck, Erskine Caldwell.
Well, you had some music,
but not really such great stuff.
When you really think about the musicians, you think about Rodgers and Hart, and you think about Jerry Kern, you think about Gershwin, and you think about Cole Porter, and that really is...
I think if you can take an attitude like that, you take away the mountains of what Switzerland, you know. You can't do that.
I felt that in the social field that there was really much more in that.
It's very hard to distinguish. I can't separate the social field into segments of that kind. I think everything that people were involved in is part of the social field. But I think theater people will tell you that some of the greatest things, both technically in the way of writing, came in the 30s. And a year or so ago, I was on a program where one of the painters dismissed the whole... art projects under the WPA, said there wasn't anybody of importance that came out of it. And I was forced to quote to him, vaguely and from memory, a review that was just of his particular show in which they said he has been influenced by six of the most prominent people today, each one of whom had been on the WPA, you see. No, I think it was a very important
period. Well, I remember the Living Theater, which of course was an unusual experiment. Orson Welles got his start out of that Federal Theater project. But I still question whether that spur of mass unemployment, insecurity, really was the most fruitful setting for a cultural renaissance. I don't feel it was.
It was important inasmuch as the government for the first time recognized that a writer, a musician, a painter, a sculptor was an integral part of society, and since he professed to be that, some way must be found for him to function. That I shall never forget.
That was the first and the last. We haven't got back to that yet.
Do any of you gentlemen think there's anything...
No, they're getting closer to it now.
Is there anything to the remark that's so frequently made about art, jazz, etc., that in that period it was less commercial than it is now? Now, we all know what's meant by commercial in this context.
I don't believe that. In fact, I really don't know very much about the whole situation we're talking about, but... It seems to me that it was necessary. Roosevelt spent these millions and hundreds of millions for these artists who were out of work, just so they'd survive. It was a question of survival. I don't see anything very beautiful about it, really anything very noble. It had to be done. These people were out of unemployed. What else could they do? You couldn't put them on a pick and shovel. He did that for the others. He appropriated this money for that particular purpose. I don't see that there's anything very wonderful or anything marvelous about it, or that they're under such great gratitude to him. He did just for them what he did for the others.
But there were a lot of people who took the view that this wasn't a proper function. I don't remember very well that great saying that if you were an oboe player on relief, did you have to be an oboe player with a WPA job? And there was a great deal of hostility to that.
A great deal.
And that was always the most criticized part of the whole WPA program.
But you asked about whether it was more commercial or less commercial. I think it was less commercial. It had to be. Because I remember playing in one of George Gershwin's shows. It was Strike Up the Band, in which they had songs like, they're singing songs of love but not for me and Embraceable You. You know, there was only one record maybe made of it. Mm-hmm. There weren't all the other offshoots of the whole business as there are now. I don't think, was there?
Well, but there was one area,
you know,
though,
now,
in which
pardon
the...
me, just one
oh,
second.
I'm sorry.
It's all tied up with the... I'm not saying I'm not criticizing it. I'm just stating a fact. It's all tied up with a record album, which is almost, in some cases, bigger than the show now. Mm-hmm. And it's tied up with a moving picture. And it's the whole scope of that particular production is much bigger. Even our business, you know, we were in it. Frankly, we were in for fun. Obviously, we got paid well. We got we did very well. But basically, we were in it as just to do something in a musical way.
Did your sudden success in, to get back to this, whether swing meant anything about the American, did it surprise you?
It
take it from these. It did. You say it did surprise.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, the way these accounts tell it,
yes,
overnight, swing hits, and it hits on the West Coast, doesn't it? Not here in the East.
But I think there was an awful lot of preparation before that,
so
to speak, like everything else, you know. I think even in politics or anything else, I think a lot of things that precede it that brings it up. Very many things that do.
There was one area in which there was a commercial development, it seems to me, of artistic appreciation in the musical field, and that was... with the rapid spread of interest in radio, you had all of these symphony concerts, the Philharmonic, the NBC Symphony under Toscanini, and then the Metropolitan Opera, which came in the 30s as something that the people all over the country for the first time had access to. Now, that was a very new development of the 30s, attributable just to the development of radio.
Of course, one thing that is often said by one school of historians about the 30s is this, that if it were such a period of great ferment, you would have expected more to have happened about the Negro, and that relatively little did happen about the Negro during the 1930s. I wonder, A, about the truth of this statement, and B, about the significance of it.
I probably could answer that as well as any other question you put so far, because I'm somewhat identified with the Negro race. I was an officer in the Negro Regiment in World War I, and for many years that I was in Congress before there was any colored congressman, the 400,000 Negro veterans all thought I was put in there to represent them. So I know something about that issue, if any white man does. And it is true. There was not so much activity. I used to lead the fight in Congress for civil rights for the Negro. And I was almost alone as a Republican member, and sometimes I'd get most of the Republican votes, but no enthusiasm. And of course, all the solid block of Southerners were against it. I put in the anti-lynching bill, I put in civil rights bills, I fought for them, almost had fist fights with Rankin of Mississippi and others. But there was no organized effort. I found very little support. I had to finally, I did get through some monument, colored monument bill for Battle Monument, and I had to fight for that. And I was counted out by the Speaker, and I remember demanding a roll call and got it through. But there wasn't the organized effort. That was the preliminary work was being done then. It's all changed the last 10 years. They've gone forward very rapidly.
What about Roosevelt and the Negro, Mr. Morley?
I don't think that the problem concerned, at any rate, the early New Deal, let us say from 32 to 36, it just wasn't an issue. So far as it was an issue, it was kept alive by the Republican Party. But there was no evidence that there was any fundamental concern there. The interest in all of the people who were in distress overshadowed the concentration of any effort to single out any one interest or any one race or any one group.
But it is true that there probably were more in proportion unemployed Negroes in the North than any other group, and therefore they were recipients of the New Deal efforts at that time.
Yes, that's
maybe
true.
Maybe that helped build
it
up.
That's true, and probably that resulted ultimately, and some time later, in the adherence of these Negroes to the Democratic Party tearing them away from the old allegiance to the party of Abraham Lincoln.
I think you're right.
Well, it was a question of who was helping him the most, and but they were included in the general relief measures.
Mr. Gooden?
Well, as a matter of fact, we had colored boys, still do, on my orchestra, even then, and I suppose it was quite unusual.
Is it correct that you were the first man to mix the races in a band when you brought Teddy Royce Wilson into Chicago? Is that correct?
Well, I would certainly say as far as a popular band, yes.
It really amazes me that it was that late.
You probably knew Jim Europe, didn't you?
Well, that's going back a little way. That's going back to the First World War, isn't it?
That's right.
But Teddy Wilson was in the band, and Lionel Hampton, and Cootie Williams.
Was this anything conscious on your part, or did it just happen?
No, we just did it, that's all. You know, we just went ahead and did it. And we went down to Dallas, Texas, and played, and they were perfectly wonderful to us. We went to New Orleans and many other places. And I must say, let me state that if they objected, we just didn't play there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had the agitation about the Scottsboro Boys. That was sort of ran right through the period. That didn't end until well into the 40s. But, of course, nothing ever happened in the way of legislation affecting civil rights. And I think that Mr. Moley's answer is the right one, that in relief they were picked up along with everybody else so that there wasn't as distinctive an economic problem for them because everybody had a problem.
Well, I suppose that during that period, an era in which Negro comedians and singers like Bert Williams sort of passed out. I think that the modern attitude on this subject has sort of taken a great deal of the color out of the colored race. They become a political problem instead of a problem of general lovable interest. You can't sing the songs anymore that were sung in those days before, let us say, 1920. You can't have any jokes anymore.
Well, that goes for other things, too.
Yes.
You mean other minorities?
Yes. But there are other minorities that have always enjoyed amusement.
A little bit touchy now.
But let me speak for a minority, the Irish. We still enjoy jokes on our own race and songs and the nostalgia that comes from old Irish songs and so on. I think that we are getting too sensitive about race these days. Instead of being attuned, let us say, to the general waves of humanity that takes in all people and has fun with them all and respects them all and enjoys their associations.
I wonder now if we can't get back to this political business, which I got you men off of, because I did want to explore that a bit. Incidentally, politically speaking, Mr. Moley, do I understand your reading of Roosevelt that he really wasn't trying to hold the Southern Democrats in line by not backing civil rights legislation? He just wasn't thinking in those terms.
No, it really was an issue that just wasn't considered in those days. There were urgent and dynamic issues. And one of the things that I'd like to point out is that the 1932, 1933, 1934, 1935, those years were a throwback to another and very vital period, and that is 10, 11, 12, 13. Most of the New Deal measures of which Mr. Fish spoke were really revivals of matters that had been issues in 1912, which was a very vital year. We get these lags of 20 years or so, just as many of the measures in the 1960s now are measures that are revived out of the second part of Roosevelt's period, the second term. That's what I call the ideological lag.
Mr. Baskin, did you...
Of course, the CIO did give a good deal of attention to equal rights. That was back in 35 when it was formed. And it operated in the mass production industries, where, of course, there were a great many Negroes employed, both steel and auto, meat packing. So that became a political issue to a considerable degree as the CIO became more prominent in the latter half of the 30s.
Well, from what I gather, the Negro people as a political party weren't as well organized then as they are now, by any means.
Not at all. But then you remember, as we got into the war, the FEPC became a big issue, and that became part of the
in the war period.
Regular war thing, and that stemmed from the educational campaign the CIO
initiated. I differ with you a little bit. I think it was largely political. Vast numbers of Negroes moved up from the South during the war times to get jobs in Detroit, Chicago, and other industrial centers. And they got the right to vote there. And they became a very large voting element of the population in those states. And they had to be listened to. And that it automatically developed the civil rights, because they had power to swing the states of Illinois, Michigan, even New York, possibly. And therefore, they could come down there as a controlling influence. And that's what really started this ball rolling of civil rights. And it rolled very rapidly. I'm very glad of it, because I was one who helped start it. But when I started, I had no one to back me up at all.
Mr. Goldman, it occurs to me that we mustn't ever forget that the depression in agriculture preceded the Great Depression. Consequently, the job opportunities in the South, which was largely agricultural, squeezed out so many Negroes who moved rather aimlessly to the northern cities. They were drifting in there, but perhaps imperceptibly in those early 30s. Because they were, agriculture was stagnant in the South, as it was in the Middle West and elsewhere.
May I cut in, gentlemen, to reintroduce you for just a moment. Here to my right, the distinguished artist, Mr. Ben Shawn. Just speaking, Mr. Raymond Moley, formerly a close associate of Franklin Roosevelt, then a critic, and now associated as a journalist with Newsweek magazine. The musician, Benny Goodman, Mr. Raskin of the editorial board of the New York Times, and Mr. Hamilton Fish, formerly congressman, and a very sharp critic in the later days of the New Deal. On this political issue, our time races along here. Well, Mr. Fish, one of the things that is very much argued about in connection with the 1930s is the extent of communist infiltration into the U.S. government and into American culture as a whole. You, I believe, were the chairman of the first House Committee to investigate communist activity in the U.S., set up in 1930, is that correct?
In 1931. Chairman of the Committee to Investigate Communist Activities in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I'll skip that, because that's a long story, investigation, and go into the question of communism itself in the United States. Communism grew very rapidly in the 30s and got into the CIO particularly. And there was a time in the 30s when the great CIO organization, the Executive Committee, was completely and totally dominated by the communists. People forget that. What a serious issue communism was in those days.
Are you agreeing, Mr. Raskin?
Well,
he can't disagree. These are factual. I mean, it's what argue. I call an understatement that I was making.
Well, I certainly would not disagree that there was very strong communist influence in the CIO in those early periods. I don't believe that they were dominant, because I don't think John L. Lewis ever let them dominate, and I'm sure Phil Murray didn't let them dominate when he replaced John Lewis as president. That they had very great power, unquestionably they did, in the CIO, very little in the AFL. And I think that if we hadn't had the New Deal and the legislation it produced, that they might very well have become a dominant influence in the country. But in the student movements, in the labor movement, while they certainly were pervasive and exercised an influence far out of proportion to their size, I don't think they ever were a controlling element either in government or in labor.
Well, I'd like to make this clear. I don't say the individual members were. There were 11 unions, as a matter of fact, that Dyes denounced as being communist, and he was practically read out of his party by Franklin Delano Roosevelt for making that statement, and he was threatened with defeat for making that statement. A few years later, they were read out of the CIO by the CIO authorities, a number of years later. I forget how many, maybe it's 10 years later.
Yeah, it was 1949.
Yeah, 10 years later. Same unions. Now, I'm not saying that outside of those unions, the others were communistic. I'm saying the executive committee were dominated, which dominated the whole thing, dominated Mr. Murray and actually surrounded him such a sense that they controlled him. It was a very dangerous thing, and they got plenty of encouragement from the administration, which I'll go into later.
Well, gentlemen have been talking primarily about labor. Mr. Shawn, the statement is also frequently made that American culture as a whole had a powerful communist influence in it. But what is your picture?
Well, I don't know how powerful it was. I was not in a position to evaluate the exact power. The fact that it did enter into the cultural picture, as you call it, is probably true. But then the entry of it was purely on a humanistic and emotional term, terms. One saw a situation that seemed, as you said yourself, the unemployment did not seem to decrease after all the efforts that were made. And this sort of pink cloud promised all sorts of things. And it emotionally appealed to any thinking person. I have heard a professor from a certain university tell me that in the 30s, he found himself at ease only with those kids who had been influenced by communism in one way or another, because he found that they were concerned with the society around them and that the others really were not at all. They were aloof to it. So that it entered there. But if one were to call that communism, and then if one thinks of a communist, say, in Russia, I can't see any relationship whatsoever.
What about Mr. Mian?
I was picketed, I remember, when we played our Carnegie Hall concert, because I played a benefit for Loyalist Spain in those days. Just remember that. But things did change quite a bit in those days. Remember one day we played a benefit for Finland, and then 2 weeks later, I don't know, they weren't on our side anymore. things were changed quite a bit, quite quickly then.
The other thing I'd like to say, I'm not a specialist enough to be able to sort of segment the New Deal in early, middle, and late New Deal and so on. But an earlier reference to a concern with the Negro, and I wouldn't be able to tell exactly what the date was, but I do remember President Roosevelt, and of course this may have been late New Deal, appointing the Southern Conference for Human Welfare, which was a body to investigate the whole situation of the Negro. I remember the people who were in it, and I remember the work they were trying to do. That very body that was appointed late, which had a semi-official connection with the government and was a private body at the same time, shortly after the war, it became a persona non grata, and it ceased to have tax deduction ability and so on, and had to change its name and so on. But there was, in the New Deal, and I remember it from the time of the New Deal, the appointment of this particular committee to concern itself with the problems of the Negro in the South, the Southern Conference for Human Welfare.
What about the government, Mr. Mulley, in connection with this problem?
In connection with communism?
Yeah.
Remember that Russia was no threat at all. It was
Mr. Fish thought
it was
so.
Only incidentally understood in this country.
No, I didn't think so.
Well, we didn't realize, or we didn't feel that it was. I favored the recognition of Russia as a de facto government. I favored it while I was in the government, but I left the government before the recognition, 2 months before. However, we were, let us say, academically interested in what was going on there. I have never been able to understand how so many of the young boys that are now so fiercely anti-communist were fools enough to become communist in the middle 1930s, and that is about when they did. However, I will say this, that I did, as one of the first, probably the third article that I wrote after I became a journalist, after Litvinov came over here in 33 in November to represent Russia in the negotiations, writing a warning to him. It was a letter addressed to Commissar Litvinov. Now stay out of our affairs. Stay out of American politics. We don't like that. Keep your agreements. It was only years later when they demonstrated they wouldn't keep their agreements, when they became a very powerful force in the world, that communism became a threat and an issue. But up to that time, it was a rather benign experiment going on far away from our shores that only a few people that I knew were interested in.
Well, Mr. Fields, yes,
I'd like to take it up from there. I agree partially with what Mr. Moley says. I think I was very much opposed to the recognition and, in fact, led the fight against it with the help of the American Federation of Labor and the American Legion and every patriotic group and every former president, every former Secretary of State was against it. It was almost united public opinion against it. He did it almost by himself, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and recognized Soviet Russia and turned them almost overnight from a third-class power into a second or first-class power. By the moral support they gave him by the recognition of the United States. They became overnight a very powerful force in the world. Up to that time, they were really, they had no moral standing. But with that recognition, then they lived up to cost nothing. They continued the propaganda in this country. They got, Roosevelt sold a bill of goods to the American people. They'd buy something like $1 billion worth of goods, and they bought three million, I think, instead of a billion during the next year.
Well,
it was
Fish,
a hoax
excuse me.
From the beginning to end. But here's what I'm against. The recognition was bad, and it turned out to be bad. But from then on, it's almost unaccountable. Franklin D. Roosevelt had a soft spot in his heart for the communists and appointed hundreds of these communists, I could name them even now, to high position in the federal government. He seemed to be very friendly with them for some reason. He seemed to believe he could handle them and handle Joe Stalin. I could talk an hour on this subject and name you the people who he appointed. It was really a very disastrous thing to America, and I think we're now suffering the terrible actions in those days.
Well, Mr. Fish, could I interpose this? Yes. You're the inheritor of a very, very, very great name. That is a great international lawyer who was Secretary of State in the 70s. Yeah. Perhaps it's my attitude toward recognition was a recognition of a fact that had continued as a principle in international law up to the time when Wilson refused to recognize a ruler of Mexico.
Mr. Moley, I have to agree with you totally.
You
it's a de facto government completely.
It was a de facto,
and that was international law under my grandfather and everyone.
It had been established.
But this was only an
years.
Exception to the rule. I agree with you thoroughly
but,
on the constitutional point of view.
As long as we could keep it out of this country.
Yes.
Well, may I interrupt here to go back to the statement. To the statement that Mr. Fish has made that Franklin Roosevelt liked communists as communists and deliberately appointed them as communists to high posts in the government. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Mr. Raskin, Mr. Sean?
Well, I don't feel that that was the case at all. I think, as Mr. Sean has said, that in this country there were a great many people, young people, labor people, and others who felt that something was seriously wrong with our economy, and who felt that perhaps the Russians had a better answer or that communism offered a better answer. And with other developments, and of course, in the post-war period, so that all of those people were not convinced ideological communists, never were, that Roosevelt himself welcomed communists into the government as communists. I think there was a certain cynicism about Roosevelt in some appointments, but that extended to the point of failing to recognize the nature of the communist conspiracy or wanting to make that part of his own administration, that seems to me a most...
Is that your picture?
I put in a very amusing incident. In the 1950-32 campaign, some of the boys whom were called the Brains Trust, over which I presided rather uncomfortably, wanted to Roosevelt to announce that he would recognize it in the campaign in 32, and This discussion was held up at Hyde Park in the library of his home. And after the discussion was over, we passed out, and Roosevelt's mother spoke to me and said, I heard something about recognizing Russia in there. If Franklin does that, I break with him completely.
Not tonight.
So he didn't come out for it in 32, and he didn't come out for it.
She was afraid of their congressman.
Can I follow this through a little bit? Because I made the general statement, and it's been picked up, and really hadn't been denied. Isaac Roosevelt had a soft spot for the communism, and that he appointed numerous hundreds of communists to high office. And they've caused a lot of havoc ever since then. But here's a written statement. He, of course, was very mad with Martin Dyes, who was chairman of the Un-American Activities Committee. And Martin Dyes was investigating hundreds and even thousands of communists. And he had a list of 2,000 communists and fellow travelers, not all communists, but communists and fellow travelers, and who he'd sent to the sent this list to the president, and nothing was done. It was pigeonholed. And then he sent for Dyes. The president sent for him twice and asked him to lay off. He says, you know, I don't see anything wrong with these people, and I wish you'd lay off.
And are you quoting Mr. Roosevelt now, or quoting Mr. Dyes?
I'm going to quote him. I'm just giving you the thing. Now I'm going to quote him. And on this on one occasion in 1939, that's the end of our period, President Roosevelt told him, I don't regard communism as an evil. Some of my best friends are communists. I think Russia is a fine, great country, and I admire Stalin. Now, who are those friends?
That's an interesting quotation. Where is it from?
That was in the printed, and I checked it yesterday, in the American Mercury magazine of September 1953, in an article written by a man by the name of Rushmore. But
you know the political orientation of the American Mercury, of course.
And, yes, but I have other, but I have other quotations, exactly the same statement. He made the same statement in a radio address, because outside of our period, when he came back from Tehran, he said he liked the communists and he liked Joe Stalin and he could get along very well with them.
Well, excuse me.
That's another thing. That's not. No, I don't mean Harry Truman. That was later on. He called a good old Joe. I'm talking about Roosevelt in a radio broadcast. But that's outside of our period of 40s.
I suppose among the 2,000 that Mr. Dyes subpoenaed was Christopher Marlowe. When he asked during the investigation of the theater, the WPA theater, and that was not being investigated because it was communist, it was being investigated because it was government supported. That's my feeling. And when they came up and talked about a certain play, he asked who wrote this. And the young fellow was being on the stand. The Times said Kit Marlowe, and he motioned to someone to get a subpoena out for Kit Marlowe. Maybe was he one of the 2,000?
No, but I'll tell you.
Well, I think there are a lot of people.
No, I'll just tell name of a few so you'll know them. Just a few.
Mr. Goodman wanted to comment, Mr. Fisher.
I think there were a lot of people that were unduly ostracized during that time, too, were they not?
I think there were. No question about it.
A great deal of them.
But we were dealing with a pretty dangerous situation. There were a lot of communists who were still in the government. Now, among those who were his friends were Alger Hiss, who went to the Alger conference.
Is this also from the American Mercury?
Oh, no, this is from me. Who were his friends? Alger Hiss, who went to the conference with him at Yalta and sat in alone with him, with Stalin. And then also, and these are all Harvard men. I'm a Harvard man. I'm only mentioning Harvard men so that nobody can say I'm prejudiced. Harry Dexter White, who practically ran the Treasury Department under Morgenthau. Lachlan Curry, who was assistant administrator to Roosevelt himself. All known communists. And Matt White, Lee Pressman, Major Ludwig Ullman, all graduates of Harvard Law School. Now, you can't say I'm prejudiced.
Mr. Fish,
this is
raking over a kind of attack which one can and cannot make. You know the kinds of answers that are usually given to it and so forth. I wonder
it's
if we could
It's never been brought out publicly before, I don't think. I don't think anybody has really given the Dyes statement or given these names or put them in that way, the jobs they hold. It's all been hushed up. It's hushed up for years.
What I think is more relevant here is your picture of the 30s in terms of our relationship to the world. Now, you were called one of the leading isolationists of the 30s. Does the title bother you?
Not a bit. I was an isolationist merely from war. not from intercourse with foreign nations and diplomacy and all that. I was opposed to war with 80% of the American people or more, or upwards. And I led that fight, and I'm very proud I led the fight. I was called an isolationist. That's just a name of opprobrium. But actually, if it hadn't been for a few of us, Taft and Vandenberg and a few others, we'd been in that war a year before, and if we had, Germany would never have attacked Soviet Russia on June 30th or 21st, 1941, and we'd been fighting Germany without Germany fighting Russia, or Russia might have been on the side of Germany. It would have changed the entire situation, so I'm very proud of my
Mr. Actions. Mulder, what is your view of the isolationist movement of the 30s?
There was a, I would say this, that the young people who were tolerant toward communism should have awakened at the time when Stalin and Hitler made their agreement. Just before, I think it was 39, wasn't it? That was the time of when everybody should have wakened up to the fact that communism was a danger, it was a treacherous friend, and an ultimate enemy. And I'm sorry that Roosevelt did retain his rather indifferent attitude toward it beyond that date.
You feel he did?
I have no question about that.
Well, Mr.
Aspin, Mr. Goldman,
wasn't
our real problem there the Neutrality Act, the Merchants of Death philosophy, the whole notion that we ought to keep apart from all this stuff because it was all a plot by the munition makers, and that wasn't something the communists started.
I don't believe it was
that. Was started by people from the Midwest.
I feel that the influence of the United States might have been thrown prior to the war, or let us say prior to 1940, in the interest of stopping this war rather than entering it. I had regretted the drift of this country toward a position as early as 1937, where we regarded Hitler and Mussolini as the number one enemy. Oh, at the same time, they were one of three enemies. By that time, it was perfectly obvious to me that Stalin had no idea of carrying out his obligations, that he was infiltrating this country with spies. We should have wakened up along about a year after 1933 when Russia was recognized.
Didn't Stalin say himself that Hitler and Mussolini were not the main enemies, but capitalism was?
Gentlemen, we have only about two minutes left here, and we're not going to be able to pursue this point. I wonder if we could use this 2 minutes directly on our subject. If there is a nostalgia about the 30s, is there anything out of that decade which this generation could learn in the way of spirit, attitude, etc.? I wonder, Mr. Goodman, in terms of this, of your own experience, is there something we could carry over from that particular decade?
Well, I believe that the youngsters who are in the arts and in politics and everything right now believe that they're absolutely right in what they're doing. I think they're honest in their approach, and I think we got to go on. I don't think you can look forward or look backwards to that.
You don't really feel there's anything particularly to draw out of that decade. Mr. Askin?
Could I suggest this as one of the things that we ought to be thinking about right at this moment as an offshoot and a product of the social thinking of the 30s? And that is that we don't have to wait until we get into this situation of mass despair, whether of unemployment or war, to do something about our social problems. We have in automation and many other things that are happening in the world today, a lot of new problems being created. And I have the feeling that we're drifting now without the sense of social purpose that was so characteristic.
Sean?
Well, I have just one memory of the 30s. I was on the WPA for 2 weeks. And I remember going up to that office and seeing side by side all the directions of art today, which today are in a violent conflict. that the government as a patron, curiously enough, was able to accept all these directions. And that, to me, is a noble thing that it happened.
I only have a few seconds. Mr. Molly, a comment, please, on this.
Well, I would say this, that the latter part of the 1930s is a time when there was sharply drawn the peril of permitting ourselves to rely too heavily upon the government. There's been a reference to unemployment. The figures on unemployment are that in the early days of the New Deal, in the early years, say from 33 to 36, unemployment went way down. But from 36 to 40, unemployment went up.
I am very sorry, Mr. Molley, and I'm especially sorry, sir, I'm not going to be able to permit you a final comment. We are cut off. I'll be back in just a moment. For this discussion, may I thank you, Mr. Ben Shawn, Mr. Raymond Moley, Mr. Benny Goodman, Mr. A.H. Raskin, and Mr. Hamilton Fish. Thank you for being with us, ladies and gentlemen, and goodbye for this week.
WNBC-TV has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind was Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Goldman's guests today were Hamilton Fish, Benny Goodman, Raymond Moley, A.H. Raskin, and Ben Shawn. Next week, The Open Mind will discuss the topic, Does Advertising Deserve Its Reputation? This has been a WNBC-TV public affairs presentation.